No, it's terribly sacrilegious, and I shouldn't even say it, that I have a good case of anthrax going through there and getting all those cattle off the street. Might have a very salutary effect on the whole life of Indians, probably, of course. Speaking of human nature, it would have a devastating effect unless it was an absolutely sure fire case of anthrax. Did the complete job.
The answer to your question is, you get all wound up in whether people like people from India or China better, and they get more wound up in that than they do in the animal issue, unless you can also complete the circle and say, how do you feel about people from these countries?
Yeah. And they say, I don't like either the Chinese or the Indian, then you're in trouble. How about these three techniques that were used on Big Business Day? One is to counter the issue. The other is to deflect the issue. And the third, not the issue, but the third is to ignore the issue.
But the trick is to know which one to use.
That's right.
You're so right. But they're all good techniques to use properly.
They certainly are. They certainly are, and it doesn't help a bit, does it? Unless we know. Well, let's talk about that then. Let's just talk for a minute about some of the research that we might be able to do. To really deal with this issue, we would need to perform mass psychoanalysis on our publics. And I have a hunch that's going to be a little difficult. We haven't yet developed a mechanism for doing that. So let's make sure that we're all clear on what research can do for us if we want to find out the answer to this. There are four types of useful data that we can get from research, and that's all we know how to do yet. So let's just make sure that we're clear on it. The first is opinion or attitude data. We do know how to collect that pretty well. The second is behavioral data. We know how to collect that. In fact, we can collect that a lot of ways without even talking to people, just by looking at the numbers of who did what and who does what, and so forth. The third is demographic data, and of course, with our great Census Bureau and others, we know all about gathering that. And the fourth is what the pollsters call environmental data, and it means just that. What environment do these people travel in? Who do they work with? Who are their friends? What is their human environment? We know how to collect data in all four of those areas. Here's the problem. Even if we get all four of those types of information, do you think we'll be able to plot a strategy that will deal with an issue as emotionally loaded as animal rights? I think we're going to have to collect the data. But I think we're going to have to relate it to another principle. And that is this, that people, remember, are willing to support an issue if they have had a part in deciding about it. We talked about that this morning. A variation of that is that people will not support an issue if we can show them that the success of that issue directly affects what's in it for them. In other words, can we try this attack? Can we relate the possible effects of an animal rights movement carried to some kind of successful outcome to values and needs and qualities that the American people hold and would not want to give up? In other words, can we deal with a what's in it for them approach? Has anyone done a force field analysis of what's in it for them if the animal rights movement were to succeed? What's in it for the people if it is not to succeed? I assume some of you have. No?
There's a corollary to this too, and that's the recent government. The government come out and said you should keep eating less meat. More vegetables, remember that thing that came out? Now there's another corollary that's running right alongside this animal welfare. And I guess if I were an animal welfare, I'd jump on that one. I don't know how we'd use it yet, but it'd be a beautiful fight.
Well, there are a lot of those issues If you're familiar, I talked about the church becoming the great activist. And the church really is. There are organizations like the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility. They represent the holders of about $20 billion in stocks, and they're putting in proxy issues before several corporations. They deal with some related issues. I wonder if the baby formula issue in Africa isn't probably one that if the animal welfare people are smart, they will try to make an association with. That, you know, people who do things for a living, whether they're farmers or Nestle's, don't really care as long as the bucks keep coming in. I assume that they probably will make that linkage using the association method. I certainly would if I were there. How about the rising movement for a fair world sharing of resources? The group that argues, I assume you've all seen their material, the group that argues quite persuasively, if you read their stuff and it sounds good, that indeed we shouldn't be growing corn to feed the animals anyway. We should be shipping the corn overseas to stop people from starving. That's a pretty tough issue. But let's for a minute look at it from a different point of view. Let's assume that the animal rights people are going to come up with such strong issues and such a good presentation that it may be necessary for the farmers to do that which they are poorest of all things at doing. And that is what you have to do in the American Court of Public Opinion sometimes: compromise, come to an accommodation. Is anybody giving any thought at all to that strategy? In other words, is there a fallback position? I don't know how to deal with an issue without a fallback position. We hope we never have to use it. It's like the fire extinguisher. Put it out there in the hall, charge it once a year, and hope that damn thing rocks, because I don't want to fire. But I want to have a fallback position, because when I want that fire extinguisher, I haven't got time to invent one. And I'm wondering if any of you are using at all the strategy of fallback position. Do you know how to do a force field analysis? I mean, it's a fancy academic name for a very simple technique. If this is the timeline of your activity, and you kind of plot out what's going to happen and what the goal or the outcome is over here, up here, you list all of the inhibiting factors. Every single thing you can think of that inhibits this, that pushes it downward, that keeps it from happening. And over here, you list all the facilitating factors, all the things you can think of that might help the arrow to get there to your goal. It's just a brainstorming kind of technique, but it's very effective because you get everything down on paper and you're less apt to be caught in a surprise. It's a way of avoiding those awful surprises. Let me give you a couple of other hints here, and then maybe we'll go on to do something else or let you out early. If you want to know what people like the animal rights folks and others are thinking, you probably ought to subscribe to one of two publications. One of them is called In These Times. It's Michael Harrington's old social democratic movement group, and they generally give a good feel, a good latency test for where the folks in that part of the American profile are at the moment. Another one is a magazine called WIN, W-I-N. It's published in Brooklyn by a collaborative of people who do it for love. They work at normal jobs and they go in and publish WIN at night. And I read WIN every week to find out where the left side of the American spectrum is coming from. Of course, I live in New Hampshire and we have a newspaper there called the Manchester Union Leader, and I only need read that to know where the right side is coming from. Well, except with that one. Some of the rest of you who don't have that, there are a number of publications also on the right. We have found in tracking issues that those publications are a good way to know what's latent or what's emerging. Because people who write letters to the editor to In These Times, or who write into WIN, are apt to be broaching for the first time something that will come along later. I remember reading in WIN several years ago, a woman writing in and saying that an un known or unexplored portion of the women's movement was the fact that women's athletics in schools and colleges was being overlooked. And I read that and I remember thinking, gee, that's really off the wall. Well, I should have read it and said, wow, that's going to be an issue. But if you're not doing that kind of tracking, you won't know what the latent issues are. Finally, let me ask you a question. How many of you have written public relations plans? If you're going to deal with the animal welfare people, you better have a written public relations plan. You better be able to defend it, in my experience, and you better have every public spelled out very clearly at the start of that plan. And there's two publics that ought to be right near the top. One is your own members, your own management. That's your first public. The second is your members, obviously. But notice that your management is first, because you've got to convince them to get them to help you work with the members. Right up near the top also. If I were you, I would certainly be identifying now by profile who the pro and anti audiences, publics, are apt to be if this thing turns into a war for you. And of course, we're talking about one issue. I got 10 other issues that I could throw at you, and you probably got 20 that you're dealing with now that you could throw at me. But I think the animal rights issue is a good one to talk about, just because it is damn difficult. I foresee you are going to have your hands full when it comes to dealing with that one. How about some questions? I have zipped through and talked around, tried to relate to what I said this morning. Let me just leave you with a thought. If you have a confrontation, remember two things. It isn't always smart to avoid them. I've talked most today about not responding. I'm not too keen on responding to confrontations, but I like to start them. Mm-hmm. Have you ever considered that tactic? You start it, you take the initiative, you become the activist. Here's why. We have a principle in our practice with movement groups. That is, we say controversy is the great American university. Controversy is the great American university. Most people are in that 80% silent majority. They don't give a damn. They're not aware of your issue. It's hard to get them motivated. But there's nothing like a controversy to at least get people to pay attention. I mean, stop to think. You're going past the grade school playground, and the teacher's over here in this corner, and she's giving a little lecture about, you know, the leaves and the birds and the bees and all that stuff. And suddenly, way off in the other corner of the playground, two little fifth graders get into a fist fight. What happens? You know, as well as I do. The crowd just moves right over there, like, just by gravity, they go over there. Because there's something about human nature that we cannot avoid a controversy. And first we go to that fight, we kind of look like this way. See him there, you know, kind of trading blows a little bit. And then pretty soon we start taking sides. I kind of like that one, you know, in the red pants. Okay. You ever notice how that happens? Hey, boy, I kind of like him. Go get him, you know. We start taking sides. We're just drawn in, first to paying attention, and secondly to taking sides. Now, hey, Mary Cunningham's story ought to teach us this again. Notoriety, controversy, being seen, being on people's agendas, has fantastic value. And sometimes we leave the play on that issue completely to the other side, to let them decide when it's going to erupt. I think that may be the strategy we should question. Maybe there are times when we ought to set the ground rules. We ought to make the controversy so that people will pay attention to us and what we're saying. At least think about it. It has, I can promise you, worked in the past. Secondly, final point. If you have a struggle with, say, the animal rights people, don't think they will go away. Don't think when it's over that it will go away. If you follow the ERA, you'll know that Phyllis Schlafly had organized a group called the Eagle Forum The Eagle Forum was a group of women in each state who were opposed to passage of the ERA. They held their convention about 2 weeks ago in Washington to celebrate the fact that the ERA did not, in fact, pass. And what did they do with that convention? Disband? Don't be funny. They decided that their new target is the public school system. And they immediately listed four very tangible goals that they are going to follow. Things like keeping sex education out of the schools, getting prayer in the schools, ridding the schools of the metric system, and ridding school texts of all feminist influences. Now you say, why is this? This is just the same thing that keeps the Farm Bureau or General Motors or anybody else going. That after an organization reaches a certain stage in its life, its goal is to protect itself and keep existing. And it has to find new causes, it will. So, the final rule that I've learned is, no matter how heated the battle, there's a phrase that I find very helpful. Remember that those are people on the other side, and that people are more important than issues. And that's not only just nice philosophy, but it's also damn pragmatic. Because once you make them really hate you, you bet your boots after the present issue is over, they'll be back to talk to you about the next issue on their agenda. And when they come back, I like to have them know me and know I'm their friend and know that we can talk. I owe you one other thing, by the way. If you want to know about what farmers have done, there's a book called American Farmers Movement by Fred Shannon, which I find fascinating. It traces the history of farmers as our original actors. I owe you one other debt, and that is to explain the theories that I have used on you today. First of all, I have kidded the subject whenever possible. If there was possible to be funny, I was funny. And the reason that I did that is just very simple. It is a standard rule of appearing before a group that you must be entertaining first. There is a shelf full of studies to indicate that no matter how much I might want to inform you, and no matter how much I might want to motivate you, essential that there be an entertainment factor. Secondly, I have tried to carry a point to the ridiculous extreme, to use hyperbole whenever I could possibly push it that far. The reason I've done that is, again, simple psychological strategy. Those who agreed with me probably felt I didn't go far enough. And those who didn't agree with me hopefully got angry enough that they'll think about what I said on the way home. If I had given you a more balanced kind of proposal, those who were with me would have said he didn't do the job, and those who were against my views would have simply sat there, probably unmoved. Thirdly, I have tried, though I know you couldn't read it, to both give you something to look at as well as something to hear for a very simple reason, and that is we know that we're apt to retain about 20% of what we hear and about 30% of what we see, but about 50% of what we both see and hear. Final example on the welfare rights incident. On the animal rights incident. I think it's relevant. It has to do, in a way, with animals, anyhow. It has to do with communication. Back in 1959 in this country, it was not possible to disseminate certain kind of literature. And the publishers of this country wanted to test that because they thought it was a violation of the First Amendment. And so they picked a particular English novel to test in the Supreme Court. The novel, I trust, is one that many of you have read. It's called Lady Chatterley's Lover. It was written by D.H. Lawrence. It's been around for a long time, but it was banned in America until 1959. If you're not familiar with Lawrence's controversial novel, the plot goes something like this. A crippled, well-to-do English lord has a beautiful young wife and a handsome gamekeeper. That's where the animal rights part comes in. And I will let you fill in the plot details. Okay? In any event, the Supreme Court said it was okay for Lady Chatterley to be published in the United States. Since it involved a gamekeeper, the magazine known as Field and Stream thought they should review the book. So I want to just share with you as a parting shot the review by Field and Stream, which of course is a hunting and fishing magazine, of Lady Chatterley's Luck. This is what it says. Although written many years ago, Lady Chatterley's Lover has just been reissued. This fictional account of the day-by-day life of an English gamekeeper, they should have it so good, is still of considerable interest to outdoor-minded readers. As it contains many passages on pheasant raising, the apprehending of poachers, ways to control vermin, and other chores and duties of the professional gamekeeper. Unfortunately, one is obliged to wade through many pages of extraneous material in order to discover and savor these sidelights on the management of a Midland shooting estate. In this reviewer's opinion, the book will never take the place of J.R. Miller's Practical Gamekeeper. If I've been saying anything, if I've been able to persuade you of anything, I hope it is that we've got such serious issues to deal with and such fantastic opportunities based on our knowledge that we have to get rid of J.R. Miller's Practical Gamekeeper and be a hell of a lot more like Lady Chatterley's Lover. Thanks a lot.
Gee, Pat, I wish there were about 150 other people, and they all knew who I'm talking about, that could have been here today.
But I do, too.
Our bosses.
Yes.
Pat, thank you, though. Let's take a break for about 10 minutes, and then we'll be talking about television. Man, it's cold up here.
Was you telling me that I don't get a phone book back?
Oh, no. It's just that I had to cut it off sometime.
Okay. The reason simply is...
Oh, yeah.
Test 1, 2.
Thank you.
Testing.
My voice won't carry as well as his. Are we back on this now?
You can plant this.
Okay, this is not fine.
Well, Larry, what'd you find out?
Thank you.